A word of caution. This episode contains depictions of murder and sexual assault that may be disturbing and triggering to some listeners. Please take caution. Over the years, there have been several different murders that have taken place involving students and staff at the University of North Carolina. In January of 1995, Wendell Williamson, a student at the UNC Law School, wounded a police officer and killed two bystanders when he opened fire on Henderson Street. In March of 2008, student body president Eve Carson was abducted, robbed, and murdered by two local men with extensive criminal backgrounds. In August of last year, associate professor Zi Yan was shot and killed by a graduate student. Faith Hedgepeth was a student that was killed in her apartment in September of 2012, and police only recently arrested a suspect in that case. But a murder that took place in the botanical gardens of the UNC campus during the summer of 1965 has never been solved. There is much to love about North and South Carolina, but the two states have also had their fair share of violent and senseless crimes over the years. From murders on the Blue Ridge Parkway, in the heart of big cities or sleepy college towns, and along the coastal waters, some of these stories may be new to you. Some may have happened in your town. Some may involve people that are still missing to this day. But all will leave you remembering to always be vigilant about the people you meet and the places you go. I'm Renee Robertson. Please join me for Missing in the Carolinas. Episode 95. Who murdered Sue Ellen Evans at the University of North Carolina? On July 30, 1965, 21-year-old Sue Ellen Evans, a resident of Mooresville, North Carolina, was taking a summer session at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill when she was attacked in the Coker Arboretum on the school's campus in the early afternoon. The Arboretum is a 5.5-acre garden at the heart of the college campus. Sue Ellen, wearing a blue-striped shift dress with red piping along the collar, an outfit she had made herself, was walking through the Arboretum as a cut-through to where she was staying in the Cobb dormitory after attending a sociology class in the alumni building. Sue Ellen had a boyfriend in Mooresville and had been planning to get back to her dorm and pack for a weekend trip back home. At the time, the Arboretum was known for being a lover's lane, and parts of it were wooded with abundant vines and foliage. Between 12:30 and 12:45 p.m., Sue Ellen was attacked by an unknown assailant. Two nearby co-eds heard screams and rushed to find the source. One of these students saw Sue Ellen lying on a bed of trampled flowers and said she caught a glimpse of a dark-skinned arm wrapped around the young woman's legs. The suspect quickly fled the scene through the bushes before the witness could get more of a description. Two nuns who were also on campus to attend summer classes heard the commotion and rushed to help. Sue Ellen had been stabbed in the chest and neck. She told the group that was trying to help her that she felt like she was going to faint and that a man had tried to rape her. The nuns tried to perform artificial respiration, but were unsuccessful. Police arrived on the scene around 1 p.m. and found Sue Ellen lying on a bed of periwinkles between two gravel walkways. She was pronounced dead on arrival at North Carolina Memorial Hospital a short time later. She was identified by her books and personal belongings that were found scattered around the scene. There was no murder weapon found nearby, but the medical examiner said Sue Ellen's wounds came from a sharp instrument that he believed was a type of knife. They collected Sue Ellen's dress as evidence, as well as scrapings from underneath her fingernails. Police took plaster casts of shoe prints found near the crime scene. A workman who was near the southwest corner of the Arboretum said he saw a young black male running toward Davy Hall, then veer off toward the Episcopal Church and Franklin Street. He was wearing a blue sports shirt with the shirt tail hanging out. Police Chief W.D. Blake ordered that the campus be sealed off, and police kept a close watch on all the roads leaving Chapel Hill. He called for the use of bloodhounds, and the dogs tracked a scent from the scene of the attack to the church near the garden, and then lost it. The day after the murder, the police chief announced six suspects had been questioned and released. By August 2nd, investigators had begun questioning people in communities outside of Chapel Hill, including Graham, Mooresville, and Spartanburg, South Carolina. they mentioned one suspect, a black male, had been questioned on Saturday, July 31st, but he refused to answer any questions on the advice of his attorney. He allowed them to make a plaster cast of his shoe and was released. Sue Ellen graduated from Mooresville High School in 1962 and initially studied home economics at Catawba College in Salisbury. After 2 years, she decided to transfer to the University of North Carolina at Greensboro as a rising junior majoring in home economics. But she had lost a lot of credits in the transition between Catawba College and UNC Greensboro, which is why she enrolled in the summer session at UNC. Her friends and family told the media that she was a sweet young woman who loved singing and sewing. She had last spent time with her family 2 weeks prior in Mooresville. Her father, Glenn Evans, was a postal carrier with the Mooresville Post Office and was on the job when he heard the news of what had happened to his daughter. She also had an older brother who was living in Virginia at the time. The autopsy revealed Sue Ellen had died of a stab wound through the heart, and she was also wounded in the neck. More than 800 people attended her funeral at the Vanderburg Methodist Church in Mooresville. On August 5th, the Daily Tar Heel announced the campus police, in conjunction with the Chapel Hill Police Department, were seeking 200 men to search the Arboretum for the murder weapon used in the crime. They were asked to assemble in front of Graham Memorial and wear old clothes. They stated the object of the search was to find a knife or similar instrument with a long blade. If anyone found anything, they were told to call one of the policemen who would be on site during the search. They planned to use a shoulder-to-shoulder method to search the thick undergrowth in the Arboretum. Later reports confirmed about 100 men showed up for the search and found no items of interest. Police questioned a white male seen on campus that day with a bloody neck, but he said he had cut himself shaving that morning. Police said they were looking for an AWOL soldier, a black male, who had reportedly stolen a car in another part of the state 5 days before the murder. Meanwhile, the Dean of Women urged students not to walk alone through isolated areas of campus. She also encouraged students who had been followed or approached on campus to report the incidents to authorities. The student body president at the time said, "Last week, the loss of a member of our student body resulted, in part, from the thickness of certain shrubs which permitted a natural lurking place for any person seeking to misuse the Arboretum." He said he hoped the university would take action and thin out the thick shrubs, thickets, and undergrowth in the botanical garden. He also said, "The Arboretum is poorly lighted and should be made more safe by the addition of mercury lamps appropriately illuminating all walkways." Recent proposals to turn the area into a formal garden with more benches and lights could cause the botany department some temporary hardship, but the beauty of the campus and the safety of our students would be enhanced. This should be our aim. This same edition of the Daily Tar Heel shared police had questioned a black male thought to be the prime suspect in the murder. He was brought in as both a potential witness and a suspect. He was questioned for 4 hours and then released on August 4th. A student had placed this man, who was about 30 years old, in the area of the Arboretum where the stabbing occurred. He did not appear to have any scratches or other injuries they could find. He denied being in the botanical garden at the time of the murder, but had no alibi. This man's wife was employed by the university. The student who identified this man said he had noticed the suspect walk through the garden almost every day. The suspect was seen walking toward the Arboretum around 12:15 p.m. on the day Sue Ellen was murdered, and leaving the vicinity around 1 p.m. A random line in a newspaper article caught my eye when I was going over the published reports in this case. An article that ran in the Charlotte Observer mentioned Sue Ellen was planning to go home to Mooresville for the weekend once she was done with her classes for the day. Her cousin, Don Gabriel, was going to pick her up along with another friend from her hometown. I wondered why the name Don Gabriel seemed familiar to me, and after going back to my old podcast episode notes, I realized he went on to become the husband of Diane Gabriel, the real estate agent who went missing from Lake Norman in 1983. We shared her story in episode 15, Missing Real Estate Agents in North Carolina. A local man was eventually convicted with murdering Diane, although her body was never found. So this means Don Gabriel had both a cousin who was murdered in 1965, and then his wife was murdered in 1983. That is more tragedy than anyone should expect in their lifetime. In August of 1965, John Kilgo wrote a column for the Charlotte Observer where he shared some observations about the atmosphere around Chapel Hill. He noted that normally you could find visitors on campus enjoying the architecture, the Moorhead Planetarium, and the old well. He described how the Arboretum was the most beautiful and peaceful spot on the campus, with flowers, grapevines, and benches for people to stop and rest. Squirrels and wild rabbits in the garden were so tame he could almost walk up to them. While he was visiting the town to work on reporting for a story he was writing about Sue Ellen Evans's murder, he said there were people walking through Coker Arboretum, some with picnic lunches for the families, trying to find the exact spot where the girl was murdered. One woman, who had walked all over the Arboretum looking for the exact spot where Sue Ellen collapsed, laughed when she said, "The whole place looks the same to me." Kilgo expressed his frustration and disappointment that a town full of grieving residents had to be disturbed by seekers of the macabre. The Daily Tar Heel published an article 1 year after Sue Ellen's murder discussing how the investigation had stalled. It reported that less than 2 months after the murder, Police Chief Blake had said the force had their hands full with parking and traffic problems in the town. The article actually stated that the Chapel Hill Police Department was understaffed, underpaid, and poorly trained. This is a direct quote from the piece. "The only time you see a police officer in Chapel Hill is when he is giving a parking ticket at a basketball game or in Keenan Stadium. Try to find one any other time and you will have a good search on your hands. But if you really need him, park your car and let the meter expire." The writer elaborated and said everyone in the community was to blame for the lack of progress in Sue Ellen's case because they were too cheap to shell out a few more dollars to support a better police department or a better fire department. Before we continue, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Are you looking to level up your writing or learn a new skill? Whether you focus on nonfiction or are more inclined to creative writing or want to learn how to put together a digital portfolio of your work, Wow Women on Writing can help. Interested in podcasting? Check out a digital course I created called You Can Start a Podcast. During this pre-recorded webinar, you will learn the benefits of creating your own podcast, materials you need to get started, how to develop content that will keep listeners coming back for more, and ways your podcast can create supplemental income. I'll share examples of different types of podcasts, how to decide on a format, ways to handle the technology necessary for creating a podcast, how to develop your first few episodes, promotion and monetization ideas, and ways you can repurpose your podcast content. All written materials and resources are provided by me. I'll also give you a handout with information discussed in the webinar, along with suggestions for a few different types of podcasts to explore. Best of all, this webinar only costs $30. You can find it by going to wow-womenonwriting.com and clicking on the Classroom tab. I'll also post a link in the show notes. Here's your friendly PSA that if you haven't been using the skincare products from SkinX Erin, you're probably doing it wrong. But it's never too late to do the right thing. The pre-cleanse oil is the best way, in my opinion, to thoroughly melt away excess makeup, sunscreen, environmental pollutants, and residual product buildup from your skin without stripping. I use their pre-cleanse oil every morning and night, followed by my daily cleanser for fresh skin. And here's another tip for the upcoming summer season. Before you go out in the sun, apply the hydrating beauty oil because it helps rehydrate the skin, reduces inflammation, and repairs the skin barrier. After spending the day in the sun, the perfecting night oil accelerates healing, prevents peeling, and can quickly help a burn turn into a tan overnight. Try it. Go ahead and treat yourself with 10% off your order using my code MissingCarolinas10. I'll include a link in the show notes for you. And now, let's get back to the show. In 1970, police traveled to Odessa, Texas to follow up on a lead because someone heard a man who hailed from Raleigh say he knew who killed Sue Ellen Evans. But it turned out he was only repeating information he had read in one of the true crime magazines that were popular at that time. Later that year, police finally got their chance to interview another suspect, a construction worker who had left his job site on the campus and never returned. He was in Central Prison when they spoke to him, and they spent several days checking out his alibi. It cleared the suspect. Not long after UNC Asheville student Virginia Olson's murder in 1973, which we discussed in last week's episode, an article ran in the News and Record with the headline, UNCA and UNCCH Killings Similar. It noted that both women were killed in the gardens on the campuses, rape or rape attempts were involved, and both crimes were committed in broad daylight. While I do have to admit there were a lot of similarities in these crimes and they both took place in North Carolina, the eyewitness accounts of the suspects are completely different, and they took place years apart. On July 28, 1997, the News and Observer published an article titled, 1965 Slaying Hasn't Been Forgotten in Chapel Hill. At that time, the sheriff of Orange County, Lindy Pendergrass, had also worked the case in 1965 as a young police officer. Pendergrass said members of the Chapel Hill Police Department had just interviewed the last living prime suspect, and he passed a polygraph with flying colors. Because of that, they said suspicion next fell on a second man who was long considered a main suspect. But by 1997, that man had already been dead for many years. Those two suspects were also interviewed in the days following the murder, but were released because of lack of evidence and a confession. In the late 90s, a patrol officer named Sergeant Harold Horn helped form a special team to dig deeper into the case. Investigators spent time reviewing the files on the case and drove to Raleigh to go over the more detailed files the FBI had collected at the time, but they still could not find a smoking gun. Horn said he believed police were distracted by their initial investigation by the flood of calls from scared residents reporting possible sightings of the suspect. If we're to be honest, I'm sure every black male in the town was reported at one point or another due to the publicity of the case. Horn said, "It bordered almost on hysteria in my mind. I can't imagine how many hours the police must have wasted following up leads and reports of things that were dead ends from the very beginning." The case remains open, although there have been no leads in recent years. If you know something, please contact the Chapel Hill Carrboro UNC Crime Stoppers at 919-942-7515 or email crimestoppers-chcunc.org. When looking at these older cases, it's always fascinating to see what else was happening in the news around the same time. Just looking through the news archives, I was able to find the following items of interest. In the summer of 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson had just signed Medicare into law. The Pegasus 3, an American satellite designed to study micrometeoroid impacts in low Earth orbit, was launched in Florida. Heavy losses in the Vietnam War were reported after a strong guerrilla attack. But one headline in particular caught my eye: two girls' bodies found in Texas. That's when I learned there had been a murder involving two female students from the University of Texas. The report I found said the bodies of two missing female students from Austin, Shirley Ann Stark and Susan Rigsby, were discovered and identified on July 31, 1965. They had disappeared 12 days prior. They were in the same sorority at the University of Texas and were both natives of Dallas. Shirley Stark had already graduated from the university, and Susan Rigsby was planning to enroll in a summer session. The two young women had last been seen by acquaintances in Shirley's car as they were heading to an expressway in Austin. A survey crew discovered the bodies of the women in waist-high grass on a vacant lot near a new housing development in Austin. The killer turned out to be someone the women knew and trusted. 22-year-old James Cross was convicted of the rape and strangulation of Susan Rigsby at his Austin apartment. He was also charged in the murder of Shirley Stark, but never tried for that case. He had been a student majoring in English at the University of Texas at the time of the murders and had once dated Shirley Stark. He was the son of an advertising manager at one of Fort Worth's leading department stores at the time. During the investigation, Cross called police and told them he wanted to confess to the murder. He testified that they had asked to shower at his apartment when they arrived in town on July 18th for the second summer session at UT and found their Chi Omega sorority house was closed. First, he raped and strangled Susan while Shirley showered, and then he attacked Shirley as she exited the bathroom. He had put the bodies of the young women in the closet of his apartment, gone out on a date, and then later transported the two women to the vacant lot where they were eventually found. Cross initially received a life sentence, but was retried 21 years later and sentenced to 80 years in prison. He was released on September 30, 1992, after serving 26 years in prison. Finally, there's one more thing I want to mention about the reporting on the Sue Ellen Evans case, and this is something that has evolved over the years. Some of the writing went above and beyond the facts in this case, and in my opinion, reporters shared thoughts and made statements that were unnecessary in these articles. An article that ran right after the murder in the Charlotte Observer was above the fold with the headline, "Mooresville Girl Slain in UNC's Arboretum." Right above that, under the masthead, were the words, "rape attempt." While it sounds like this was a true statement based on what Sue Ellen said before she succumbed to her injuries, I don't believe it needed to be spelled out above the headline. Another article that the Charlotte Observer ran on September 13, 1965, participated in quite a bit of editorializing. It discussed the timeline of what Sue Ellen's plans for the day had been on July 30th. The headline read, "Where was she 30 minutes before her death?" This article reported that on that morning, Sue Ellen was probably planning to skip lunch because, and I quote, "friends had talked her into going on a diet because she was plump. So far, she had lost 5 pounds," end quote. First of all, what is the point of mentioning that she was on a diet? And second, I don't believe there was any mystery as to where she was heading before going into the Arboretum. She had a sociology quiz at 9 a.m., which finished up at 10:30. Then she had an education class at Peabody Hall, a 5-minute walk away. That class was cut short, and she left the building with a female classmate, and they talked by the old well for a moment. Sue Ellen told her friend she had to see her sociology professor about the course and went back into the alumni building, arriving between 12:05 and 12:10 p.m. The professor she was planning to speak with had already left for lunch. The article mentioned her movements between that time and about 12:35 were unknown. In all likelihood, she was probably lingering in the building, waiting to see if her professor would return, and then headed to the garden. I don't think this supposed 30-minute gap was anything worth turning into a news article. And as you can imagine, the descriptions of the suspect were also quite interesting, but I won't repeat them here. While I was researching this case, I found the details of a very unusual story involving the wife of a Chapel Hill professor who was murdered in their apartment just a few months after Sue Ellen. I will work on putting it together for a future episode. This brings us to the conclusion of this episode of Missing in the Carolinas. If you enjoyed this episode, please do me a favor and give it a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, so please like our pages and get started on a discussion of the missing people profiled on the show. Do you know of a missing persons case in North or South Carolina that you think should be covered? Email me at missinginthecarolinas@gmail.com with any details you can share. And don't forget to check out our sponsor, WOW Women on Writing, and the great programs and writing contests they have to support writers at www.wow-womenonwriting.com. Treat yourself to a skincare kit from SkinX Aaron with my code MissingCarolinas10. Cover art for this podcast was designed by Macintosh Multimedia. Sound editing is provided by Daniel Robertson. Thanks so much for listening.